Hello, and welcome to the MIT Press Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Gondek. And today I'm speaking with Thomas Lin about the books Alice and Bob Meet the Wall of Fire, The Biggest Ideas in Science from Quanta, and Prime Number Conspiracy, The Biggest Ideas in Math from Quanta. Thomas Lin is the founding editor-in-chief of Quanta Magazine, an online publication that reports on developments in science and mathematics, with content syndicated in publications such as Wired, The Atlantic, Scientific American, and The Washington Post. Lin previously worked for The New York Times, where he edited online features and wrote about science, technology, and tennis. He's also written for Quanta, The New Yorker, Tennis, and other publications. Stay tuned after the interview for more information about the show. Thomas Lin, thanks so much for taking time to talk to the MIT Press Podcast today.
My pleasure, Chris.
Now, these two books, Alice and Bob Meet the Wall of Fire and Prime Number Conspiracy, are collections of articles from the magazine Quanta. For those people unfamiliar with Quanta, could you describe what its mission is?
Sure. I think the simplest way of putting it is that Quanta is a magazine really for anyone who wants to understand how the universe works. And, you know, I think what makes us different maybe from some of the other science magazines out there is that we focus on the big fundamental questions in science and mathematics. We don't follow or care so much about more applied areas of science, like technology and engineering and medicine and health and those areas, which are all very important, of course, and what much of the popular press does a great job of covering. But we focus on what you might consider the most basic fundamental questions. You know, how did the universe come to be? What are all the different sort of things that make up the universe? What are the fundamental forces and how do they work together? How did life begin? What is life even? In some of these, big, deep questions, the research behind it, or especially at the forefront of trying to answer some of these questions or at least gain new knowledge, tends to be very, very technical. And it's hard even for other researchers in adjacent fields to fully grasp. And so what we do as journalists is we try to make that information as accessible as possible to the general public while also being true to the research in terms of trying to accurately cover the science and to actually tell people what the science, what's interesting about the science itself. I think one of the challenges, again, in science journalism, at least in the media in general, is that you have lots of stories that make it appear that something happened, but don't really tell you what it is that happened and how that advance or result came about. And so we try to do that in both an accessible and engaging way, but we try not to skimp on the science itself.
I was going to say that particular tension in science journalism between dealing with scientists who have something to say but might not necessarily be, grand sweeping statements. There's a lot of equivocation with some of these issues in science versus the journalistic need of, like, I have to tell a story that is, I don't want to say necessarily punchy, but I have to keep the reader's attention just because of the nature of journalism. You know, I guess working with that tension to me would seem to be both as an editor and as a former scientific journalist. I shouldn't say former because I know one of your articles is in her co-author article. It must be interesting to sort out how you, I guess, address that tension between the two sides.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think that's a concern, I would say, that many scientists have in what they're seeing out there. And also, I think a lot of journalists too, in terms of that tension between how do you make the results of, again, very technical research both accessible and engaging without misleading people, right? And I think that's unfortunately a challenge that we see in some of the coverage that can seem either superficial or can occasionally cross into the territory of either hype or even being misleading when there's an attempt by some editors or writers to make it appear that something has been settled for good. And I think part of what we try to do is not only accurately represent the result itself, but to convey how science itself is done and to not, I think if you read our stories, you don't generally get the sense that whatever result we're writing about is some kind of settled knowledge, and science itself is provisional. We're constantly revising, or not we, but you know, the researchers who are working on these problems are constantly revising the current best theories and trying to use experiments and other data to figure out the best way forward. And so we try to capture that and not present our stories as this is all we know, because really, you know, that's part of what's interesting and fun about science, is that there's so much that we don't know and there's so much to explore.
So now let's talk about the books in particular. Alice and Bob Meet the Wall of Fire is a collection of quanta articles about the world of physics. But the topics range from recent developments in quantum theory to questions about the nature of life and of the mind. Actually, as I was looking through it, it seemed that the organization seemed to be almost from, like, I want to say kind of a funnel, from like the biggest questions down to kind of the some of the more smaller questions. Not that the question, what is life, is necessarily a small question. But when you think about it, as opposed to what's the nature of reality, the nature of time, it kind of looks small in comparison to those. But an overall shape of the articles, I kind of got a sense, question of, what do you know, if it's fair to say that physicists are having trouble going from big to small, connecting the macro view of the universe when we think about Einsteinian relativity theory, and then the micro view of the universe of quantum theory. It seems that on the poles, physicists have a pretty good idea, a rough idea of what's going on, but when they try to connect the two, that's where they're starting to run into some problems. Is that accurate?
That's an interesting way of thinking about it, you know, I think that is true. I mean, I think there, you know, people who are following what's happening in theoretical physics, you know, may be aware of, there is an incompatibility between Einstein's general relativity and quantum theory, and that's one of the problems in trying to come up with a theory of everything, is that those two theories don't play well together, and therefore it's hard to find a theory that can explain all of the four fundamental forces. String theory does that, but there's no empirical evidence for it. And so one of the issues is, even at those poles of the very smallest and the very largest, it isn't possible to gather empirical evidence to support some of these ideas, like string theory, for example, or to go back far enough in time to know exactly what happened at the beginning of the universe, or, you know, to confirm whether cosmic inflation happened, for example, or something like that. And so one issue is that at the poles, we've already reached, our theories have reached a state, we've crossed the boundary at which we can no longer fully test some of these ideas, which is one challenge. But as you said, there's also the other challenge of connecting things at different scales. And I think one of the interesting themes that's emerged, I think, in recent years in science is this idea of emergence, right? Whether it's in physics or biology or other areas of science, this idea that there are emergent properties whether it's through phase transitions or however you go from one state to another, it isn't always possible to understand that transition, or to, say, study all the you know, microscopic subatomical components of a system to try to understand sort of the larger phenomena that can happen when they all interact. And so there are a lot of unknowns out there, and that's really what the book is about. And it's not only an exploration of from big to small, but in some ways it's somewhat chronological as well. It's sort of talking about these big questions about the origins of the universe, and then sort of moving along to questions of life emerging, and then, you know, people, like what makes us human, and how our brains sort of work, and then on to now questions of, as we're exploring the universe and trying to make sense of it, how are we going to do that when we've kind of reached the limit of what we can physically test?
As people may or may not know, I've done podcasts for a long time, and I was actually talking to a former guest about going back almost 10 years, but 2009 was the 150th anniversary of The Origin of Species. And obviously back then I got a lot of books about Darwin and a lot of books about evolution. And one of the things I really liked in the questions about life in Alice and Bob Meet the Wall of Fire is, and it got me thinking about the fact, there's an article in there talking about how, although evolution is important, actually evolution might be a subset of a bigger issue that goes on in life. And in fact, I mean, I found that fascinating. Could you talk briefly about that?
There is an idea out there. I think it's pretty you know, eye-opening and it's thought-provoking, let's say. Not all biologists, you know, fully sort of buy into it yet. And it's sort of, again, that's what you were talking about in terms of trying to make physics work with biology, for example. And so there is this idea out there that was developed by many in the past, but more recently by Jeremy England at MIT, at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, that the idea behind this is that life, even though it seems like life is this very ordered, structured thing, and how can you get that if everything is going from a low entropy state to a high entropy state? There's this idea that actually you could, life itself could be one way to dissipate heat and essentially create a situation where you have higher entropy. And so it could very well be very inevitable and a natural consequence of the laws of thermodynamics. And that's, you know, a very interesting theoretical idea for how life could have got started. But, you know, we still need to figure out the exact mechanisms and, you know, what were the molecules and how did they actually come together. And so that's where, you know, sort of the chemistry and biology haven't quite connected with some of these ideas. But this is a potentially more universal way of thinking about life and evolution.
Let's talk about the other book, Prime Number Conspiracy, a collection of quanta articles about the world of mathematics. And as the title suggests, more than a few of the essays look at the current state of prime numbers. I remember back in high school, I had fantastic math teachers all through high school. And a trigonometry teacher who was beloved by all of his students there was nuts about prime numbers. And it never really connected with me just simply because I don't know if at that point that part of my brain had opened yet. But what is it about prime numbers that makes them such an important area of mathematical research?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, if you think about number theory specifically, you know, you want to understand how numbers work and the structures of numbers, and prime numbers are essentially the building blocks of numbers, right? They're kind of like the atoms in the periodic table. And if you think of prime numbers almost like metaphorically the elements in the periodic table, then all the other sort of molecules that you could potentially create are combinations of those, right? So you multiply prime numbers to get all the other composite numbers that exist out there. And so they're interesting for that reason. And then also you want to know, you know, what is the distribution of prime numbers, right? And what are the gaps between prime numbers? Are prime numbers, you know, in some sense random in the way that they appear in the number line? Or are there other sort of forces at play? And these are all just fascinating questions because, you know, numbers are in some ways the simplest, most fundamental aspects of mathematics. And what's interesting is that, you know, while the firm connections have not yet been found, there are signs that there may even be connections between some of these questions of the distribution of prime numbers with areas of physics, for example. And that's just incredibly deep and fascinating. There's actually one of the book, The Prime Number Conspiracy, starts with just a really interesting story of an unlikely discovery, or a discovery made in some ways by an unlikely source. There was a 50-something-year-old mathematician who did not even have a job as a professor. He was a lecturer at a university and had spent many years after getting his doctorate basically working at places like, you know, Subway sandwich shops and not having a job in academia. And on his own, he was working on this very fundamental number theory problem about prime numbers called the twin primes conjecture. And the twin primes conjecture basically asks, you know, are there, or actually it conjectures that there are an infinite number of prime number pairs that are only two apart. So like 5 and 7 and 11 and 13 and 17 and 19, those are twin primes because they're only two apart. But as you think about the number line, as you go farther out on the number line, we see that prime numbers become sparser, right? There are fewer and fewer prime numbers. And so it's not at all obvious that you should continue to see these twin primes as you go out along the number line at all. or that there's any bounded gap at all between prime numbers. It could be that they just the gap grows bigger and bigger, and there's, you know, that you never find an infinite number of any pair of, not just of two apart, but of any finite number. And so while this mathematician, Yi Tang Zhang, did not prove the twin primes conjecture itself, he did make a major, major advance in proving that there are, in fact, an infinite number of pairs with a bounded gap, of a finite gap. And he just used the number, you know, 70 million as the gap, just because it was easier for him to prove. And since then, other mathematicians have taken that and reduced that gap down. But that was an enormously big advance in number theory from somebody who was completely unknown in the field. And that created a sensation in the math community. He was traveled around the world giving talks. He was offered jobs, of course, after that. And also it's led to lots of interesting results. And it pushed forward, you know, our understanding that there are, in fact, infinite numbers of pairs of prime numbers with a finite gap.
Now, I realize this next question might be a little bit like asking a father, which of your children do you love best? But are there a particular article in either book that you think is going to have the most far-reaching consequences for either the future of physics or the future of mathematics?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I don't want to talk about a specific research result because, you know, many of these ideas are highly, theoretical, and they're interesting ideas. They are ones that researchers are thinking deeply about and could push things forward, but they're somewhat speculative too, and so it's hard to say whether, you know, which idea will necessarily pan out. But some of our stories have also reported on developments within the fields of physics and mathematics and biology itself, and one of them I think is at least it gets at one of the key debates right now that's happening in physics, which is, you know, we just talked earlier about how right now physics is the theories themselves are probing scales of physics that we can't really test, and we're unable to get any kind of empirical evidence to support some of these theories at either the small scales or the larger scales. And so it raises the question of the nature of evidence, of scientific evidence, especially when we can't access empirical evidence to support one theory over another. And so that raises the question of, can we then turn to purely mathematical evidence, for example? Is that something that we can at least give us more confidence in pursuing certain ideas? And there was a big debate in Munich a few years ago where physicists and philosophers of physics got together to sort of hash out these ideas. So this is, you know, one of the things that I think is going to be important for physicists to figure out, as we move forward and try to develop ideas in the absence of empirical data. The other thing I think that's, I think for me thinking to the future is, there are some of the stories that we have in both of these books talk about these growing and very surprising connections between pure mathematics and areas of science, mostly physics and areas like string theory, that you wouldn't necessarily expect. And it's, you know, again, these connections are still not fully developed, and physicists and mathematicians are still trying to understand what they mean, but they're seeing some of the same numbers and structures across, again, from number theory to particle physics. And this gets at this deep question that Eugene Wigner, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, wrote about back in 1960, this question of the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. Like, why is it that math that was developed for its own sake, not necessarily to try to model or understand something that you were seeing physically, how is this pure mathematics then somehow able to work and help us explain real-world phenomena? And that's a really deep question. I think that could bear a lot of fruit in the future.
So are there some social media links for both the work that you do and as Quantum Magazine so people can continue to follow what's going on?
Yeah, sure. The Quantum Magazine is on Twitter at Quantum Magazine and on Facebook as Quanta News. We're also on Instagram, YouTube, and places like that. And please do follow us. And you know, this is really an adventure for us to be covering these areas of fundamental science. And we hope you'll join us for the ride.
I hope we do too. I really liked both books very much. Thomas Lin, the editor of Quantum Magazine, and I guess the collector of essays in the collection of articles for both Alice and Bob Meet the Wall of Fire and Prime Number Conspiracy. Thanks for being on the MIT Press podcast today.
Thanks so much, Chris.
For more information about these and other titles, please visit our website at mitpress.mit.edu. Don't forget you can find the MIT Press on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thanks for listening to this episode of the MIT Press Podcast. Copyright 2019, the MIT Press, all rights reserved.